yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to look at some reports and see what they tell us about this very precarious condition in the U.S. and global economy today. Well, let's start with the jobs report. Today, the U.S. Labor Department released its latest report on U.S. jobs. And, didn't look so good. After all the hype of the last 6 months, now it looks like jobs are slowing again. And, you know, job numbers are what is called a lagging indicator. In other words, they start to soften 3 to 6 months after the real economy begins to soften. Oh, we've been saying the real economy is doing so good in the U.S., and now jobs are starting to soften. Well, maybe over the last 6 months, the U.S. economy was not doing so well. What are these job numbers? Well, the numbers here for September, job creation, according to the first survey called the Establishment Survey, which is a survey of data that's provided by about 500,000 companies to the Labor Department. It's almost like a quasi-census. You know, it's called the Establishment Survey. And that survey showed, by the way, it's heavily biased towards larger corporations. Small businesses don't get picked up here very well. But it shows that a gain of only 142,000 jobs in September. And the previous months, where it was hyped, job creation, were revised downward as well. So over the last 3 months, July through September, we have a average growth of jobs of 167,000. Now, you got to keep in mind that the U.S. economy requires about 125 to 150,000 jobs, new jobs created a month, just to absorb people coming into the labor force. So if you're at about 150,000, 160,000, you're just able to provide jobs for those coming in. You're not really reducing the jobs adding jobs to those who are unemployed already in the labor force. It's a kind of a churn going on. And I've been saying for some time that the job market, labor market in the U.S. is really moving sideways like a crab. It's churning. No real improvement going on here. Churning in what sense? Well, as I just said, as new workers come in, they get jobs. Older workers drop out. Yeah, they drop out of the labor force, and that's been a big problem. Why are they dropping out? People don't really know why. Some try to cover it up by saying, it's people who are retiring early or retiring. The baby boomers retiring from the labor force. Well, you know, it happens to be that the fastest-growing job age group is people 65 and over. More of them are entering the labor force faster than any other sector or grouping, age grouping, and faster than ever before. Well, they're coming back to work because they can't afford to retire, you see. So I don't buy this thing that it's baby boomers who are retiring here, and that's why we've got people leaving the labor force. I think we got people leaving the labor force because they're just discouraged. Oh, but they say we have numbers for discouraged workers, and, you know, it only shows a couple million. I don't believe those numbers either. It's much greater discouraged workers than they're indicated. They're not picking it up. You know, they're having a hard time identifying that particular number. How do they get these numbers? Well, they make a round of calls. Every month, the Labor Department calls through its other survey called the Household Survey. It calls households and says, well, are you working? How long has it been since you haven't been working? Well, you know, you can pick up those people who have regular established residences and have established phone connections, right? Landline or other phone connections for some time. In other words, it's part of the stable workforce. Ah, but those who are dropping out are the younger and the unstable workforce. And they're harder to contact, harder to reach, you know, not apt to talk to the government, and particularly the minorities, immigrant labor and so forth, they're even less likely. And if they're undocumented, 11 million of them in the U.S. economy, they're certainly not going to talk to the government when they're trying to be surveyed. So these household phone surveys are biased towards a more established workforce and a better paid workforce. Okay, so when they call to see how much is discouraged, how many have dropped out, and so forth, they're getting an over-optimistic estimate of that, I believe. That's one of the problems. There are many problems with these job statistics, as I've been saying for some time. But in any event, you know, they are an approximation of sort, but not accurate. Don't believe that these job statistics are the absolute truth, because another problem is they're statistics. They're not the real data. Oh, what do I mean by that? Statistics. Well, statistic is, by definition, you take the raw data and you do a statistical operation on the data. You smooth it out. You adjust it. You know, for various reasons. You add in other estimates. It's a formula. And these statistics, statistical methodologies, I think, are out of whack in some cases. They're based on an economy in the 80s and 90s, which has dramatically changed here after in the 21st century. They're not adequately updated, in my view. So statistical operations are not the same as raw data. And that's another reason why I don't think they're really picking up what's happening with people dropping out of the labor force and a churn going on, new people coming in, 150,000 a month, and at the other end of the tube, at least that many who are going out. Right? For example, the total civilian labor force in the United States here, about 157 million people who are working or unemployed. That's how we define the labor force. And civilian means everything except the military, and that includes private sector and government. Right, it's about 157 million in the U.S. Well, that civilian labor force, according to the report today, declined by 400,000 in just 2 months. 400,000 people, the labor force, declined by 400,000 in 2 months. Where did they go? Oh, well, if they're not in the labor force, they're not working. Did they all retire? Were this all the baby boomers retiring, or is it people who are just dropping out and working in a shadow economy, or you know, not working and living at home, youth living at home with their parents, you know, because they graduate from school and college, they can't find jobs anymore, right? So the numbers are suspect to some extent, but you know, I'm not saying they're phony. I'm just saying they're increasingly inaccurate. Right? But even in their inaccuracy, it shows that there's a decline going on in the last three months in job creation. Right? Only 138,000 on average for the last three months of jobs created. That's the lowest level of job one-quarter job creation since the first quarter of 2011. Okay. That's an interesting piece of information, isn't it? lowest job creation since 2011. And that's why you see the stock market choking on these numbers today, particularly the bond market, the big surge going into long-term government bonds as a safety haven, because they see the U.S. economy slowing down. Well, you know, in the past, when we've had a poor job number, the stock market goes up, right? Because they expect the Federal Reserve now, because the economy is weak, to keep pumping money into the economy. But wait a minute, it didn't go up today. Why is that? Well, because it looks like the Federal Reserve's trying to raise interest rates. That means less money being pumped into the economy. Oh, so that, therefore, the stock markets, equity markets in the U.S. are confused right now. Well, is the Fed going to raise rates or not raise rates? Well, maybe we'll find out in December. They really want to raise the rates because they know another recession is going, and they have no more monetary bullets to shoot if it does, and when it does, Yes, I think it's coming within the next 12 to 18 months. Because the U.S. economy cannot continue to grow, even at its anemic rate, which is less than 2%, when you adjust out the redefinitions of GDP that have been made to falsely boost it in recent years. When you adjust that out, it's growing less than 2%. And that anemic 2% growth cannot be sustained when the rest of the economy is stagnant or declining. There's no way. Right? And we're already seeing a sharp decrease in U.S. Exports and manufacturing as a result. Right? Even before the U.S. raises rates, short-term rates, we're already seeing that happening. Manufacturing jobs declined here in the latest report. Construction jobs stagnated. Okay, with stagnating construction and manufacturing declining, well, that's where the higher paid jobs are, unless it's management jobs. Yeah, that's the higher paid jobs. And if that's not growing, declining, well, then wages are not going to grow. And that's been the big problem. We can't get wage income growth going. And that's why you can't get a takeoff of the U.S. recovery, because you need consumption, almost 70% of the economy. You need consumption to really take off. Oh, they say, housing is doing good, right? No, housing hasn't even recovered half, two-thirds of what it had. And most of the housing construction that's going on is not being bought by average Americans. It's being bought by foreign money flowing into the U.S. and shadow banks, private equity firms, hedge firms, buying up and renting out homes in the U.S., so we got a big rental need in the U.S. You know, we had 14 million people who were foreclosed during the crisis. They got to live somewhere. So, there's a boom in rental, a multifamily construction. You know, the housing industry is high-end for the rich folks coming in from Asia, right, and now Latin America. It's multi-unit apartments. That's what it is. The true housing, single-family housing, is not really going anywhere. So, check off housing as a source of recovery. Check off manufacturing and exports as a source of recovery. And that leaves you with consumption, right? Business investment in the U.S. has been slowing, as it has everywhere. Real investment, in real things, in goods and transport and buildings and plants, industrial plants, all this, all that's been slowing dramatically, not just since 2009, but over the last decade. There's a big problem in the global capitalist system of declining, in other words, slowing rate of increase of real asset investment. And that's manufacturing and construction and so forth. It's slowing down. And as it slows, it can, the production output slows, and the hiring slows, and the high wages become less of a proportion in the economy. And that means you can't get wage growth. Then you destroy the unions on top of that, and in a recovery like this last one, they couldn't generate any wage increases. Right? And then you got problems with minimum wage and the shifting to part-time work and temp work, which pays less, and they're all doing that now, all these industries everywhere. You've got less wage growth. Well, you hold down minimum wages, you shift people from full-time to part-time work, you destroy the unions, and you export the good jobs, and then you get slowing real investment in manufacturing, industrial production, and so forth, you get slower wage growth that way. The only people getting real wage growth are business professionals and managers. It's all skewed to the top. So when they say there's a 2% increase in wages over the year, that's the high end. That's the top 10% of the workforce, which is mostly supervisory and business professional. Right? That's what that is. You take your average production non-supervisory workers in this country, they're at best stagnant. And if they're below the median, they're going backwards. There's no wage growth. Mm. And they know it. You hear them talk about, we need to raise wages, right? Well, politicians can talk all they want. Economists can say all they want about the need for that, but business isn't going to do it just because you say so. No, and that's true, not only here, but in Japan and Europe and everywhere. Europe, we see you have chronic unemployment, 11%, still 11%. Now, they more accurately estimate their unemployment over in Europe. The closest thing to a more accurate estimate in the United States is not what's called this U3 unemployment rate. That's so phony, and they keep referring to that. That's that 5.1%. That's an absolute worthless indicator because of the way it's defined. The better indicator that almost never gets reported in the U.S. press is what's called the U6. And that counts all the people, even underestimating, who are part-time temp, right, working, and lower wages and so forth, right? The U6 unemployment. Well, what is the U6 unemployment rate in the U.S.? It's 10%. In Europe, it's 11. Here, it's 10%. Okay, 10% of what? Of 157 million in the labor force. So that's 16 million people still unemployed. 5 years after this recession apparently ended in June of 2009, wages, real wages, are actually lower for the majority of the workforce for all these reasons I gave. You see, when they count about count what your what wages are, they not only don't count part-time temp, hourly wages are full-time. So they don't count part-time temp, and they don't count all the people who have left the labor force who are unemployed. If you're talking about wages, you're talking about a wage bill for all people who are working for a wage or a salary, right? Getting paid for their labor, Take all those people and add up and average out, what their total wages are. And then, of course, you then make your adjustments and you include in it those who are unemployed. They have no wages. They're getting transfer payments called unemployment insurance, if they're lucky, for a little bit of time. And how about all the people who are hired or moved from full-time to part-time? Okay, so, wages aren't growing 2%. Come on, wages, you're lucky if they're stagnant, I believe. They're growing for some, but for most, no. And just as the unemployment is a lot larger than it is, and those two things, of course, are related. If unemployment is really greater than it is, not counting all the people leaving the labor force, which has been 6 million people at least since 2009. Okay, so 6 million come in, one door, right, new hires, come in at low wage, low-paid service jobs, right, or part-time temp, right? They come in one door of the labor force making low pay, and out the other door are the older folks and others who are leaving the labor force. And since they've been in it longer, their average pay is higher. they're leaving it. They're going the other way. So you get this churn going on. There's a churn as well between union labor and non-union labor. There's a churn between part-time and full-time. A churn between high-paying manufacturing construction and, at the other end, low-paying service jobs. It's a crab-like job economy moving sideways. But it's critical. It's critical for consumption and getting the real economy going. Okay, it's not getting the real economy going. We're not making the transition to a consumption recovery. And, of course, businesses see that, so they don't invest. It becomes a vicious cycle, right? They weren't investing much anyway, but now when they see low consumer demand, they invest even less in expansion that would hire people. Right? You know, and also a lot of the problem here with our jobs number in recent years, why it's overestimated, I believe, has to do with the shale oil boom. A lot of the job creation has been very regional. And that means, you know, in the Dakotas, in Texas, and a few other places where you had this shale oil boom. And, of course, you know, in shale oil production, it's a hazardous, dirty, difficult job, so the pay is higher. So now, though, we have this massive contraction going on in the shale oil sector in the United States, and we're having mass layoffs occurring. As the shale fracking, you know, oil, gas fracking, decline sharply. And wages are going to be impacted by that decline as well. And maybe we're beginning to see some of that already in these lower numbers for jobs in the most recent quarter here, July through September. Maybe, you know, that's beginning to bleed through. The retreat of the shale oil sector is beginning to... with a lag here, as jobs usually are, is beginning to be reflected. So why is the shale oil sector contracting? Well, that has to do with global politics and global economics, and specifically, it has to do with the Saudis and their Emirate friends. They felt threatened by the U.S. shale oil industry because, you know, U.S. was a big area for their sale of crude oil, but with the shale fracking boom, the U.S. become more self-sufficient on its own oil now. Of course, it's at the cost of a major environmental crisis that it produces. But you know, that aside, you know, the U.S. shale gas and oil—it's mostly oil, shale oil. They talk about shale gas, you know, but the real play here is oil comes up with the gas. You see, some places is gas, but you know, big beneficiary of all this is U.S. oil production, crude oil production. So it comes up, and the U.S. became more or less self-sufficient here in recent years, and the Saudis see that. And the Saudis, in 2014, about a year ago, decided to take on the U.S. shale producers. These are mostly startup companies, right? And small, medium-sized drillers and so forth. They become bigger, of course, in the process, and they borrowed a lot of money from U.S. banks by issuing what's called a high-yield junk debt. In other words, pays high interest, so you know, investors desperate for yield, for interest returns, you know, buy these junk bonds from these shale oil gas companies. This is going to be a big problem because as these companies go under here, these U.S. shale companies, as a result of this fight with the Saudis, a lot of this junk bond debt is going to collapse, and it could spread. As financial asset collapses tend to do, to other non-shale junk bonds, and from there to other corporate bonds, and who knows from there where else. Okay, we have this crisis going on in the shale oil sector because of this fight with the Saudis. The Saudis have driven the price of oil down in order to try to drive the U.S. shale producers out of business, and to some extent it's working. And the Saudis have deep pockets and deep wells, and they're willing to take big losses in order to drive out these competitors so that they can better control the price of oil once again, as they have in the past. In the process, though, it's wreaking havoc here with other oil-producing countries whose economies, heavily dependent on revenue from global oil sales, are now collapsing. Who are these? Well, obviously, in Latin America, we have Brazil, and especially Venezuela, in deep trouble because, you know, the global price per barrel of crude has fallen from what was $120. It's in the mid-40s. And the predictions are it's going to go further. Some predictions now, you know, from banks, Goldman Sachs recently estimated it can go down to $30 a barrel. Well, that's going to drive a lot of these U.S. shale oil companies out of business. They can't sustain on $30 a barrel. Just what the Saudis want. Oh, but where are the big players like Exxon, right, in this whole thing, and BP? Oh, they love this game. Yeah, they've always been allied with the Saudis, of course. And as the Saudis drive the shale oil producers out of business in the U.S. fields, Exxon and the others come in and buy up the best ones, and position themselves to be the real victors in this fight between the Saudis and the shale producers. You know, and in the meantime, emerging market countries, you know, like Brazil and Venezuela and Nigeria and Africa, right, Indonesia, Angola, these are all oil producers, and they're in deep, deep trouble. Their economy is heavily dependent on oil, are all in deep recession. And as that occurs, you know, you have economic dislocation in these emerging markets. And if they're in deep recession, then the foreign finance capital that had been flowing into these economies turns around and flows back to New York, to London, you know, Frankfurt, Tokyo. The money flows back. Well, when the money flows out of the emerging markets, well, that exacerbates the crisis already even further. Right? What do these countries do to try to stem the necessary money capital to keep their economies going? Because they are dependent on foreign money capital. You see, finance capital from the advanced economy still rules the world. There may be more industrial capital that has moved offshore to these emerging markets in the last decade or so, but finance has not. Finance still rules the world, and it's still situated in primarily New York, London. All right, so the capital flows back, flows out of these countries, and these countries, in desperation to try to keep it in their countries, they raise their interest rates to keep attracting the foreign capital. Well, raising their interest rates slows down their domestic economies. It gets even worse. Oh, then they cut budgets because their economy is slowed and they don't have tax revenue, so they cut budgets. In other words, they take it out on the hides of the working class, right, and small businesses. Make them pay for the crisis that you know, this global oil fight has precipitated, and the currency flow. Now, it's not all because of oil. It's also because the U.S. and the U.K. are now creeping towards raising their interest rates, and that reattracts back capital from emerging markets, and even from China, you know, which was an emerging market. It's kind of like the premier emerging market. I wouldn't call it emerging anymore. But we have massive capital flight from China, as well as from all the emerging markets. And that capital flight sets in motion other problems that get piled on top of it and exacerbate it. What are these other problems? One is the currency collapses in these economies. Their currency collapses. Right? Well, if the currency collapses, all the more reason why money investors in advanced economies don't want to send their money into these emerging markets now. You know, you take your dollars into Brazil and you've got to convert them to Brazilian real in order to spend them and invest them there. Well, if the Brazilian real currency is collapsing, you know, I may buy so much of the currency today and the next day it's worth 10% less. Who wants to take that risk, you know? So currency wars, which are exacerbated as well by Europe and Japan, who are engaging in these dueling quantitative easing policies with each other and the rest of us to drive their currencies down so that they can sell more of their exports in a global economy that is rapidly slowing in terms of global trade. Dumb move. Well, they think it's more profitable, at least their investors there, because it means free money for them. QE drives down the currency, you know, and it means free money from the central bank. They'd rather have free money than take a risk and expand domestically, internally, their own economies. Right. It gets very complicated. All these things are connected one to the other. Okay. Let's talk about global trends here and the other two reports. The World Trade Organization recently released a report on global trade. Prior to the crisis in 2008-09, trade for well over a decade had been increasing. Global trade, exports, imports between countries have been growing more than twice as fast as the global economy itself, GDP. Add up all the GDPs of the countries, right? So that's the global GDP. Well, global trade was rising faster. In other words, global trade was driving a lot of the global GDP increase. However, since 2011, right, that global trade increase has been less than the increase in global GDP. And global GDP has been slowing. Global trade is slowing even more. The WTO, World Trade Organization, recently halved its prior forecasts and noted that for the first time, global trade may have actually contracted in the first half of 2015. Look, we are in a global trade recession already. We are in, globally, a global industrial production contraction recession already. The global economy, you know, in terms of trade, industrial production is already in another recession. It's only a matter of time before that fact spills over into the service sectors. Service sectors are always last to join the contraction here. Industrial production, by the way, is what? It's manufacturing, it's mining, and it's utilities. Utility production, you know, gas, electric, whatever. That's what we call industrial production. With the contraction of the oil shale sector in the U.S., you know, and the contraction of exports, net exports in the U.S. and therefore manufacturing for export, right? We are darn close ourselves in the U.S. to an industrial production recession. Okay. And yet we see all these forecasts. You take all these official agencies or institutions, you know, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, WTO, and so forth. These global international institutions are slowly reducing their forecasts. You know, they're still forecasting a growth in world trade, but you know, every 6 months they reduce their forecast even further. This is a problem. These agencies are always overly optimistic, as are central banks, in forecasting what's going to happen. If you look at the record of the forecast since 2009, always overshooting their prediction. And then they come back and they adjust it, right? And they still overpredict it. It's, you know, they're way behind the curve, consistently behind the curve. And I think intentionally and purposely behind the curve. But the fact is, they're always overestimating the trend. In my forthcoming book, comes out in about a month here, we're just updating and adding to it. It was supposed to be out in September, but it looks like October, November, probably November 1st, called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. And in this book, which is almost a 500-page book, a thorough overview, review of the global economy and where it's at, why the recovery has been so uneven and subpar historically since 2009, and why we are headed towards another global recession and or financial crisis. In this book, I start out in the first chapter taking on these global forecasts, you know, forecasting real and financial instability. By the way, not just the real economy that these forecasts are about, but the financial side, the financial instability, which these forecasts, official forecasts, almost never have much to say. You know, they're forecasting the real economy, GDP, and so forth, but you know, financial assets and securities are not included in the GDP forecasts. But they obviously destabilize periodically the global economy. How can you not forecast? Well, they're not so good at forecasting finance and financial instability, but it has to be forecast, because in this book I am interested in a new way of estimating how financial cycles and real cycles interact and exacerbate each other. You know, most economists are not trained in finance and don't understand the financial sector. They're trained in looking at, you know, real indicators, real economy indicators. That's what GDP is all about. But they don't understand the financial side, and they certainly don't understand how the two really interact with each other. Oh, they have some analysis, but it is so rudimentary and so inadequate that they never forecast and predict financial crises. You know, just a handful of them might, but most of them don't. You know, most of the economists, 10,000 of them in the world, you know, miss these turning points and these financial eruptions. That's because they're not trained to look at it from that perspective. You know, and people in you know, in business schools on the finance side don't understand economics. You know, they're just interested. You know, they believe this nonsense about efficient financial markets and so forth. So they're even dumber, you know, when it comes to forecasting. Well, in this book, I'm trying to create a new conceptual framework to better understand how financial cycles and real cycles interact with each other. You can get more information of this from my website, www.kyklosproductions.com, kyklosproductions.com. Or you can go to the publisher, Clarity Press, and look up my name there, and there will be a synopsis of the book and the long six-page detailed table of contents shows you not only the title of each of the 19 chapters of this book, but the detailed headers and subheaders, subject matter that I'm addressing in this book. The first part of the book really challenges these global forecasts, and that's chapter one. Chapter two, I talk about what's called the dead cat bounce global recovery from 2010 to 2014, and why it's ending. Dead cat bounce, you know, that's a metaphor. You know, cat may die, and then he jumps up all of a sudden, runs around, you know, comes back to life, and then he flops again, you know. And that's why things happen economically here. We had a little recovery after 2009, particularly in China, emerging markets. Now that's rapidly dissipating, and the rest of the global economy and the advanced countries can't get going. You know, we have perpetual recession in Japan. it's in its fifth recession here now since 2009. It's fifth. It's been in recession more than it's been not in recession since 2008-9 crisis. And then we have Europe, which is a chronic stagnation, you know, sort of the Eurozone sort of, you know, seesawing between a negative 1% growth and there was a recession and a positive 1%, you know, sort of bouncing up and down between negative 1, positive 1 in terms of GDP, can't get going either. So chronic stagnation in Europe, a perpetual recession in Japan, those are chapters. Another chapter on the emerging markets perfect storm. I've alluded to that a little bit, but I've been writing on that for some time. For 2 years now, I've been predicting this crisis in emerging markets. As the money flows back out for various reasons, capital flight from these countries causing currency collapse, exacerbated by dueling QE currency wars, Japan and Europe, and rising U.S. rates, currency instability, collapsing stock and bond markets in these countries, emerging market countries, particularly Latin America, other global oil commodity and commodity futures, another financial asset collapsing, you know, China's stock market collapsing. Right? So emerging markets perfect storm is another chapter. Another one is China. Bubbles, Bubbles, Debt and Troubles, entitled. You know, particularly looking at the stock market collapse and the financial bubbles that preceded it, you know, in asset products and in housing and construction. China's been battling these bubbles, not without much success. Right? Kind of playing economic whack-a-mole, you know, with each bubble. Each time it smacks a bubble, the money flows into another bubble over there. In the meantime, the economy is slowing steadily. You know, this 7% growth rate in China is a joke. There's no 7% growth rate in China. You know, they're lucky if it's 5%. And some have even said it's as low as 4.1. I think it's somewhere between 5-5.5%, much slower. And the most important thing is it continues to slow. So, you know, there's in the first part of the book, looking specifically in detail, you know, what's going on with China and Europe and Japan and emerging markets. The second part of the book is looking at 9 specific variables and factors that are responsible for growing financial and economic instability in the world economy. What are these 9? These 9 are slowing global investment that I talked about, real investment, not financial investment, that's been going on everywhere. Globally, capitalist economy is shifting from real investment to a financial investment for a whole number of reasons. And drift towards deflation. Deflation in real goods and services, particularly, is occurring everywhere as real investment slows. Deflation in goods. Disinflation means, you know, you got a slowing rate of price increase, slowing, less and less of a rate of increase. That's disinflation. A lot of countries are in disinflation. The U.S. is in disinflation. You know, prices now, whether you look at, you know, whatever indicator, PCE or CPI or whatever, GDP deflator, et cetera, these prices are down below 1% now. Yeah. Central banks say, oh, we got to get up to 2%. Well, everything's been going in the opposite direction. QE programs are supposed to justify to get the price increase back up to 2%. You know, that's the central bank's target. But it's not working. In fact, it's going the other way. So why are they continuing with QE? Because the QE has nothing to do with inflation. That's not what the objective is. The objective is to pump free money into banks and speculators. keep the stock markets and bond markets going. That's what all QE is about, free money. And these financial markets have become addicted to getting that free money. They can't get off that addiction. And that's what these central banks are doing with QE. Oh, secondarily, they're trying to drive down their currency, as in Europe and Japan, which they have done, to try to grab a little bit more share of global exports in a slowing global trade pie. They're all fighting over a smaller pie, at least in Japan and Europe. You know, it's all export-driven growth is what they're trying to do. That's what QE is about secondarily. And they think exports are going to drive their economies back up to recovery. Well, that's not happening either. QE is not causing real goods and services to increase. It's feeding financial asset prices. And yes, it's reducing currencies, but that's not stimulating export growth because the global economy is slowing and everybody's doing that. You see, everyone can play that devalue my currency by QE game. That's what they did in the 1930s, except then it was, you know, formal declaration of devaluation of their currency. Now it's the devaluation by QE, by money injection. And everybody can play that game just as they did it in the 1930s, and the result is the global economy slows. That's exactly what's happening. So both Europe and Japan are fighting over a smaller pie, which is a dead-end strategy for economic growth. Ah, but it keeps your wealthy folks happy, doesn't it? And it keeps your corporations happy. Rather than putting money in the hands of consumers to stimulate the growth, no, put the money in my pocket, they're saying to these politicians and these central bankers. They, meaning wealthy investors, the 1%. No, the growth has to come through me. You've got to give me more money, and maybe I'll dribble some of it down to the rest of the poor folk. Right? Well, that's not working for various reasons we've said. You're getting a bare recovery for everyone else, but a huge recovery for those on financial assets. You know, I talked about here a week or so ago how corporations, just in the U.S., just the largest 500 corporations, have divvied out $5 trillion minimum in stock buybacks and dividends and private equity, you know, partner sharing to their shareholders. Well, they could divvy it all out because profits have doubled in the U.S. Well, they've doubled not because they're selling more stuff because people can't buy it. They're doubled because they're cutting the cost. It's all cost-driven profit. And those keep wages low. Now, they've driven wages so low, they can't get consumption going again. You see? So they say, well, you know, in the short run, just keep the money coming to me through QE and zero interest rates by the central banks, and let's hope it recovers, it improves in the meantime, you know. But don't turn around and stimulate, don't give it to them, us, in other words, in their wages and their income, to stimulate buying my products. You know, I don't want to make money by selling more. I want to make money by cutting my costs. And that's what we're stuck in. And these folks have control of the political system and the politicians, so that's the strategy. And that control is getting greater, as we know, you know, Citizens United and subsequent decisions, you know, they can spend all they want on their politicians. And the politicians are whores. They're owned by these people. And they do whatever they say. And what they want is, me first, keep it flowing, keep the free money flowing, the subsidies flowing, and let's hope it gets better in the long run. No, let's not get in too much, you know, at this government spending that'll put money in the hands of the average family and worker that will stimulate product demand, and I will have to produce more and make more money that way. No, I kind of like what's going on where I just cut their wages. Let's stay with that strategy, you see. That's why everywhere around the world what you see is monetary policy, QE, zero rates. free money in the hands of the wealthy and the investors, in the promise, false promise, that it'll trickle down. It's not even trickle down anymore. It's drip, drip. That's the strategy. And there's no fiscal expansion strategy going on. There's no spending strategy. There's nothing that really boosts wages and boosts incomes of consumer households. In fact, in certain places, like Europe and Japan, it's let's go in the opposite direction. We want fiscal austerity. Because the slow growth means government deficits rise, you see. And if they rise, someone's got to make up the difference. So let's take it out of the hides of workers, working families. Right? Don't spend on programs that benefit them. In fact, cut those programs. And it's most dramatic in Europe and Japan, but here as well. You know, when Obama first comes into office, he spends $800 billion. On a stimulus program, adds, maybe another 50, 60, cash for clunkers and first-time home buyers in the summer of 2009, 10. That doesn't work, so he's got to inject more into the economy, and they convince him, well, it's got to be tax cuts for the rich, you see, corporations that are rich. So in 2011, what does he do? He pumps in another $800 billion in tax cuts for them. Well, that's about $1.6 trillion, right? It doesn't really get a recovery, a sustained recovery in the U.S. So in 2011, what happens? They take $1 trillion out, the first deficit cutting, right? And then we get the fiscal cliff nonsense, and they take another $500 billion out. 1.5 billion out after 1.6 billion in. Most of the 1.6 billion went to state and local governments and corporations and the rich. But the 1.5 trillion, trillion numbers we're talking about here, 1.5 trillion they took back in 2011-12, that comes out of the hide of government spending on social programs, education, and so forth. See? So the U.S. was, you give it one hand and you take with the other back right away. But in Europe and Japan, fiscal austerity means you don't give anything, you just take, you see. take out. And that's why their economies are even in worse shape than the U.S., you see. But globally, that's been the strategy of global capitalism here since 2009. We're going to rely on monetary policy, free money. We're going to boost these financial asset markets, stock and bond markets, right? We're going to get rich, and the whole justification was we're going to recover right away, and we'll share it with the rest. Well, they didn't share it. But they have so much political power that you can't change the politics of that. And so we continue, and they talk about more QEs. Already they're talking about another QE in both Japan and in Europe. Even more, they're going to double down on policies that don't work, aren't working for 6 years now, but it keeps the rich happy, keeps investors happy, the global finance capital elite, who I talk about in my book as well. The nine key causes here, I started talking about that, slowing real investment, drift towards deflation, right? Disinflation first, then negative deflation, right? Both goods inflation and financial asset inflation, rising global debt, exploding credit, money, and liquidity by the central banks. That's four. Five, the shift to financial asset investing, reducing real investing. Structural change in financial markets, the rise of the shadow banking system and the global financial capital elite in all this. Structural change in labor markets, how they're keeping income down in the labor markets, transferring it to the business side, just as they are changing financial markets, so more and more of the capital incomes benefit. And then monetary policy, how it's creating fragility, and fiscal policy, how that's creating fragility in the global system as well. So nine variables. And from those variables, I developed this new conceptual apparatus for explaining what's going on, which is not the same as used by mainstream economists, nor is it the same that's used by Marxist economists, at least that wing of them that talk about the falling rate of profit explaining everything, including sunspots, right? Nonsense. Falling rate of profit. Nonsense. We have a crisis with escalating profits, record profits. You know, the empirical facts just don't support that thesis. Plus, it's a thesis that derived from Marx, but they don't really understand how Marx meant it to be anyway. And then I talk about this economist, Hyman Minsky of the 80s and 90s, who pioneered a look into financial instability. Important economist, had some important insights, but limits to his analysis as well. So this theoretical side of this book, you know, in the first part, I'm looking at what's going on, in these four key sectors of the global economy. In the second part, I'm looking at what's going on with these nine key variables. And the third part, what I'm looking at is the theoretical side of the picture, both mainstream economists, Marxist economists, and what's called the Minsky Group. And then in the very last part of the book, I'm proposing my own theory of systemic global fragility, which is dependent on neither of these other trends. I think all these other trends are working off a conceptual framework that is inadequate to understand what's going on in the global economy today. Well, I'll be saying more about the book once it comes out here in about another month. May have even a series of discussions on it, and will certainly provide on my website and on my blog, jackrasmus.com, some selections here so people can start at least debating. You know, I don't have all the answers, but I think we better look in some new places for some answers. So what we're looking at globally here, third report that we started talking, you know, about the U.S. jobs report, the World Trade Report on global trade, the IMF is coming out with a report next week. All right, IMF has been one of these that has tended to overestimate the global situation, economic situation, over-optimistic, as all of them have been. Their track record shows that for the last 6 years. But in a preliminary statement before the release of the report, the IMF director, Christine Lagarde, noted here this past week that there was a sharp deceleration in global trade going on, and emerging markets are in their fifth year of slowdown. And in 2015, once again, GDP is going to be slower and trade is going to be slower than GDP. The EMEs, emerging markets, are in big trouble because of what the China slowdown, the dropping, collapsing commodity prices, U.S. dollar and rate increases. All these things are going to continue and get worse, and so emerging market situation is going to get worse. The IMF points to this incredible rise in corporate debt in the last decade here. Corporate debt, in other words, selling of corporate bonds and loans and so forth, has risen from $4 trillion before the 2008 crisis to $18 trillion. They are borrowing their way just to keep the global economy just to keep its head above the water. You know, it's been a terrible recovery. And even those areas that had a little bit of recovery, China emerging markets are collapsing now. And they've spent $14 trillion, and this is what, you know, capitalist business has got out of this, $14 trillion? Okay, we'll talk about this some more in the coming weeks, and particularly the IMF's report that comes out next week. This is Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions.